Minutes, tuned to Yesterday with an hour of collection curios. I'm your host, Mark Levonier. The old-time radio collection at WRVO Public Media, known as the Ellen Robinson Memorial Library, contains tens of thousands of broadcasts on reel-to-reel tape, and there's a vast archive of the big-name shows from radio's golden age, but among the shelves are series with very few surviving episodes, one-off programs, underheard tapes, and long-considered to be rare broadcasts. In this hour, we'll get the reel spinning with programs not yet heard on our show, or at the very least, on the air in a very long time. Later in this hour, we'll hear a portion of a radio and TV simulcast with then-Senator John F. Kennedy on Meet the Press, but right now, a snapshot of what radio variety was like in 1963, several months past what was considered to be the end of radio's golden age, when stations dropped pretty much all radio drama from their schedules and started to focus on music and talk. NBC had already begun to adapt this change with their pioneering program Monitor, a weekend show heard from 1955 through 1974, bringing four-hour blocks of music, interviews, vignettes with old-time radio notables like Fibber McGee and Molly, news and remotes from everything from performances to horse races. ABC Radio wanted to pick up on the success of the show and brought on TV and film star Dick Van Dyke as the lighthearted host in a short-lived series called Flair. Dick actually got his on-air start in a branch of Armed Forces radio at the tail end of World War II as a disc jockey after his attempt at joining the Army Air Forces didn't pan out. Here's an episode of Flair from ABC, broadcast in April of 1963.
Radio forecast, fair and warmer. Happy music, top performer. It's sunny here, so stay in tune, 'cause it's gonna be Flair this afternoon.
Hi, this is Flair, and I'm Dick Van Dyke. Now let's go over, not to Davy Jones's locker, but to Larry Storch's, as he takes out a couple of smile-worthy stories.
Now if your wishbone's connected to your ear bone, and your ear bone's connected to your funny bone, now prepare for your funny bone to get connected to Flair.
This is Larry Storch for Flair. You know, I think people can get a good laugh around their neighborhood if they just keep their eyes open and listen to the conversation. And I'm always reminded of the little story of the two women who were talking over the clothesline, and one woman said to the other,
"Did you see what Fidel Castro did last month? Did you see what Castro tried to do last week? Did you see what Castro tried to do yesterday?" And the other woman said, "I don't see nothing. I live in the back."
And then another one I'm always thinking about and I got to chuckle out of. There's two women who were talking. One said to the other, "Martha, what do you think about red china?" And the other one said, "Red china? Well, red china on a yellow tablecloth is lovely." And then this happened right around our neighborhood tavern. A woman came into the bar looking for her husband. She'd found him at the bar and he was drinking pretty good. And she says, "Oh, Harry, come on home. No more whiskey. Let's go home together, arm in arm, just you and me. The kids are waiting for their dinner and Grandma's coming over. Your favorite cowboy show is on. What do you say we go home?"
The husband says, "I'll go home with you only after you take a little drink yourself."
And she was trapped, and she did, and she took it down.
Oh, she says, "Harry, whiskey is terrible. It tastes like poison, just like poison."
And the husband says, "Yeah, see? And you think I'm out having a good time."
Judy Garland says this is her lucky day. It's also John Steinbeck's lucky day because 61 years ago today, he was born.
Day. I'm all in clover. I'm glad all over. I want to shout hooray. I found a horseshoe, couldn't go wrong. And then, of course, you happen along. This is my lucky. Oh, wow, I'm lucky. This is my lucky.
Flair decorator Betsy Palmer says the newest thing is ersatz fur. I wonder what it'll be when they finish killing off all those ersatzes.
Here's Betsy Palmer for you to tell you just what you can do with paint and with fabric and decorating abric, a dabrak too.
This is Betsy Palmer for Flair. You know, it's interesting how one can keep up with decorating trends. For instance, I got a tip on a trend from a baby photographer. No, he wasn't a baby. He takes pictures of babies. And one day, he was taking one of my baby.
Miss Palmer, how about taking one of the baby lying on a fur rug? It's a big thing nowadays.
He went on to explain that in a lot of the homes he visited, there was usually something in fur that he could use to pose the baby on. Well, I must confess I was a little dubious at first, because the only baby on rug photographs that I'd ever seen were taken of my great-great-grandparents when they were babies, and you know how long ago that must have been. Well, anyway, I did some checking and learned that the photographer was correct. Furs are now being used by the modern homemaker in a variety of ways. Does this mean that more and more husbands are beating the bush in African safaris? No, simply that science has given us a marvelous array of synthetic materials that are almost the exact replica of furs ranging from zebra to mink. Not only are they easier to obtain than authentic furs, but they're cheaper and easier to work with. Consequently, instead of merely using them for throw rugs, the new synthetic fur materials can be used for covering sofa pillows, folding screens, hassocks, or anything else to which you want to give an exotic look. One thing to remember, though, don't go overboard in your predilection for furs, lest your neighbors and friends begin to think you're too fur out for comfort, for goodness sake.
Thanks, Betsy. The Orchestra of David Rose is on the thorns of a dilemma about what to play. Word has it they'll settle on Some of These Days. Hollywood interviewer Joe Layton asked actor Gig Young how he got his name. So simple. I'll bet all he did was spell G-I-G backwards.
From Gina to Marlin to Tarzan on down, Joe Layton circulating with the biggest stars in town.
From time to time, I've told you how certain movie stars got their names. Some of them, like Jack Lemmon, fought mightily to keep their real names and succeeded. Others were simply told what their new names would be, like Gig Young, whose real name is, or was, Byron Barr, which sounds more like a movie star's name than Gig Young. Doesn't it, Gig?
Yeah, it's too phony, isn't it? Almost.
Yes.
Byron Barr. No, I think that I'm not keen about the name Byron, strangely enough. I don't know why. But,
what do your friends call you?
Gig.
Is Gig something in your background that...
Well, actually, this was not my doing, but the very first part I played in a motion picture was Gig Young. And second picture called The Gay Sisters. You know, those were the days, Joe, when people went to a preview and they filled out cards saying they hated it or liked it or what did they like and what didn't they like. And the people who referred to me not one person referred to me by the name of Byron Barr, isn't that strange? But they referred to me, those who referred to me, as Gig Young. So Jack Warner said, well, he said, that sounds marvelous. He said, would you object to changing your name to Gig Young and we'll redo the, the front end of the picture and say Gig Young, played by Gig Young. And that's how I got the name.
Wait until you hear how movie star Sal Mineo fought to keep his name. Maybe next week we'll get around to it. Meantime, Joe Layton here in Hollywood for Flair.
Carlton Fredericks tells about some of the things that can happen 25 years from now. Well, for one thing, you can watch Cleopatra on The Late Show.
Nutritional whiz kid Carlton Fredericks has advice for you to follow and vitamin information for you to swallow.
This is Carlton Fredericks for Flair. I'm going to assume that this is a group about 40 years of age. That shuts out women because all women are 30 or approaching it. Except they won't tell us from what direction. Now, if you are a group approximately 40 years of age, we can say that about 60% of you or more will survive to the age of 65. But the insurance companies tell us also that about 60% of the survivors, or 36% of the original group, at the age of 65, will have as constant visitors from there on through the twilight years such degenerative diseases as arthritis, diabetes, heart trouble, high blood pressure, and hardening of the arteries. This degenerative disease, says Dr. W.B. Kuntz, writing in Industrial Medicine, is not a necessary concomitant of aging in years. He says disease changes are the results of phenomena of exhaustion that may be corrected, and he attributes this concept to new knowledge about nutrition, the influence of proper food on the human mechanism, and the effects of stress. He emphasizes that older people need hormone treatment and vitamin treatment and mineral treatment. Even though they have adequate blood levels of these nutrients, they still will respond, he says, to supplementary administration. And proper medical management of individuals in the middle years in this way may add at least 20 years to life, he promised.
Here's Peggy Lee.
I could have danced all night. I could have danced all night and still have begged for more. I could have spread my wings and
and a thousand things I've never done before. I'll never know what made it so exciting. Why all at once my heart took flight. I only know when he began to dance with me, I could have danced.
Garden expert Ruth Alampy says it's very important to test your soil. Next step after that, of course, is to grade it.
You can overcome and ungreen some, have harvest like the farmer in the dell. Just don't despair, start digging flare and garden to a fare well.
Hi, Ruth Alampy for Flair. Parlez-vous français is one of the few phrases left over from my high school French. It's not necessary to understand French to be a good gardener, but there's one basic garden term that comes from the French language. This down-to-earth expression is pH. The symbol pH is an abbreviation of the French phrase puissance de hydrogen. Now, rather than get involved in a discussion of hydrogen ions, let's just settle for the fact that pH measures the active acidity of a substance such as soil. It's expressed by numbers on a scale. The neutral point on the pH scale is 7.0. As you go lower on the scale, towards 1, the pH value becomes more acid. Higher than 7.0, it becomes more alkaline. It's important to know the pH of your soil because some plants like acid soil, others alkaline, and many neutral soils. A plant that likes a fairly neutral soil with a pH of 6.5 to 7 will sulk if planted in soil that has an acid pH of 2.5. That's why soil tests are important, to see how the soil rates and how it should be treated to adjust the pH to the requirements of the plant. If you haven't had a soil test taken recently, check with your county agent or State College of Agriculture and find out how to get a soil test mailing kit. This is a good thing to do as soon as you can get a trowel in the ground to get a soil sample, and you'll have taken the first step to having a more successful lawn and garden in the coming spring.
To keep all you prospective anglers from floundering around, I have prepared a glossary of very fishy definitions for you. First, there's surf casting, auditioning actors for a Russian slave musical. Trawling, an Irish song. You remember the Rose of Trawling? Angling, the country where Elizabeth II is queen. Perch, founder of right-wing society, first name John. No fishing, the object of nuclear test ban treaty. Night crawler, that's Sir Lancelot's baby. Reeling in, how Charlie Weaver arrives for the show. Sturgeon, that's someone who gets called to sturgery. Bobber, a fan of the Attorney General. Tuna, that's the channel selector on an Italian TV set. Nylon line, a sail on stockings. Waiters, if you ever find out how to catch their eye in a restaurant, let me know. Well, that should land a lot for you. I've got to go now before I get the hook, or the people with a net, at the very least. Mm-hmm. Ella Fitzgerald is going fishing, where she'll wait with bait to rout some trout, amass some bass, or maybe flounder will surround her.
Woke up this morning, wanted to cry. Then I remembered, yes, I know why. He's a real good one for having his cake. I'm gonna go fishing or jump in the lake. I'm going fishing, that's what I'll do. Think about nothing, not even you. Catch a real big one, a big speckled trout. Snapping in the water, I'll pull him on out. If a man is a liar, a man is a fool. Playing for keeper and breaking the rules. He'll be the loser, yes, he'll find out. I'm gonna go fishing and catch me a trout.
If you've been cooped up in the house or apartment all afternoon, here's your chance to get out as we travel to Jerusalem for a report from ABC correspondent Marlon Levin.
To Marlon Levin, Jerusalem is home. So come in, Levin, to you, bless and shalom.
Marlon Levin, ABC, Jerusalem. For the more cultured sector of the Israeli population, the national pastime is trying to buy season subscription tickets to the Israel Philharmonic Orchestra. The orchestra has the largest number of subscribers of any symphony in the world, and still there is a big demand for more. It gives over 200 concerts a year, and subscriptions are at a premium. The search for one such subscription by a Jerusalem music lover not so long ago resulted in a marital finale scored in a minor key. The music lover had only one subscription, which he shared with his wife. He wanted to buy another so that he could attend concerts together with her. All last season, he noticed that one seat near him in the concert hall was empty. This season, he contacted the orchestra management to buy it, but he was told that it was sold. The music lover asked for the owner's name and phone number. He called the number and said, "I understand that you have a subscription to the concerts, but I noticed that all last season you did not attend. Would you be interested in selling me the seat?" Silence on the other end for a few seconds. Then a man's bewildered voice replied, "I bought that seat for my wife. Are you sure you did not see her at any of the concerts?" Not long after that sour note passed, a suit for divorce was opened in a Jerusalem court. The deceived husband quickly got his divorce and sold the music lover the subscription. When last heard of, the absentee concert goer went off with her lover, but not, as one might hope, to a concert. Marlon Levin, ABC, Jerusalem.
Thanks, Marlon. Peggy Lee sings the new Frontier song, "I'm Walkin'."
Down and cry. What you gonna do when I say bye-bye? How you gonna
gonna do is dry your eye while I'm walking. Yes, indeed, and I'm talking about you and me, and I'm hoping that you'll come back to me.
Definitely one of the more unique shows in our collection. That was the ABC variety program Flair from April of 1963. You're listening to Tuned to Yesterday, bringing you an hour of collection curios. I'm Mark Levonier. And it was the brief joke during the silly fishing term segment that referenced Bobby Kennedy that inspired bringing this next bit of tape from the archives, and that is a radio and TV simulcast of Meet the Press, featuring then-Senator John F. Kennedy. His first national television appearance was actually on this program in December of 1951, where the topic was on the suspicion of communism in executive departments of state. Communism was very much on the mind of lawmakers and the public in the 50s, with Kennedy fielding questions about the fiery anti-communist Senator Joseph McCarthy, and he addresses the communist insurgency in Indochina in this next episode, a topic he would formally present to the Senate a couple of months later, where he famously said, quote, "No amount of American military assistance can conquer an enemy which is everywhere and at the same time nowhere." This is a fascinating look at the attitude of one of the country's most revered leaders before he became president. Here's John F. Kennedy and his third of eight appearances on the program from February 14, 1954 on NBC.
Ladies and gentlemen, the program you are about to see will be broadcast in color using the RCA-compatible color television system. By compatible, we mean that you can see all color broadcasts in black and white on your present sets. The RCA color television system uses the new color standards approved by the Federal Communications Commission. And now, ladies and gentlemen, Meet the Press, the Peabody Award winner. Ready for this spontaneous, unrehearsed press conference of the air are four of America's top reporters. Their questions, please remember, do not necessarily reveal their point of view. It's their way of getting a story for you. Here now is this evening's guest moderator of Meet the Press, Miss Dina Clark.
Good evening, and welcome once again to Meet the Press. Our guest tonight is Senator John F. Kennedy. He is the third Democrat in the entire history of Massachusetts to be elected to the Senate from that state. His sensational victory created international interest. He is in the news again because of his position on the St. Lawrence Seaway and the Bricker Amendment, and also because of his membership on the important committee considering revisions to the Taft-Hartley Act. Politics come naturally to Senator Kennedy. His father was ambassador to the Court of St. James under President Roosevelt, and his grandfather was a famous mayor of Boston. Seated around the press table, ready to interview Senator Kennedy, are Marcus Childs of the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, Mrs. May Craig of the Portland, Maine Press Herald, Mr. Ned Brooks, NBC commentator, and Lawrence Bivak, regular member of our Meet the Press panel. And now, Senator Kennedy, if you're ready, who has the first question? Mr. Childs.
Senator Kennedy, as you may have seen, Chairman Leonard Hall of the Republican National Committee said that Senator McCarthy was one of his party's assets. Do you agree with that?
Well, probably Mr. Hall is in a better position to judge that than I would be. He obviously thinks so because the National Committee is sponsoring Senator McCarthy's speeches during the Lincoln Day week. So that I would guess that probably his judgment is probably better than mine as to what would be an asset of the Republican Party.
Well, you as a Democrat, do you think that in the campaign this fall that Senator McCarthy will make votes for Republicans, or will he help your party indirectly?
In some states, I would think that Senator McCarthy would help the Republican candidate.
Do you agree with President Eisenhower that Senator McCarthy, he didn't name him, but I think he meant Senator McCarthy, and Senator Jenner and others have gone too far in the charges they've brought against the Democrats?
Well, as I remember what the president said at his press conference, he stated that he wanted those in his immediate executive, the group around him, and the Republican National Committee to not to go to excesses in partisanship. I don't know whether, and he also said that he had no real control over other members of his party, but he did deplore any excesses of which I believe the gentleman you mentioned were guilty during the last week.
Well, what about this charge, Senator Kennedy, that the Democrats are constantly crying depression And that equates more or less with the Republican charge.
Well, I don't think it equates. The Republican charge, which has been made during the last week, is that the Democratic Party is a party of treason. The charge made against the Democrats are that the Democrats are crying and attempting to push the country into a depression. I don't think either one of those charges are true. I think it's natural that with the sharp increase in unemployment during the last few months, the predictions which have been made about the country income going below up to 5 or 10% below what it was last year, which would be a serious situation for us, it's natural that the Democratic Party, and I'm sure many Republicans, are concerned about what steps the country should take to prevent a serious recession or even a depression.
But it is true that you Democrats ran for years against Hoover, didn't you? And the Hoover Depression?
Well, I understand that's true, and I think that was unfair to Mr. Hoover. On the other hand, the Democrats did have a different program to meet the Depression with, which I believe was more successful than the program of Mr. Hoover and the Republican Party. But that's far different, I think, from calling the Democratic Party the party of treason, referring to the 20 years of the Democratic Party's control as 20 years of treason, saying that we were deliberately attempting to lose the Korean War. I think that goes beyond the legitimate areas of party dispute, and I think it has a serious effect upon the country's morale, and I think it's unnecessary and untrue.
Mrs. Craig.
Ms. Somerville, the people of this country are afraid of a little Koreas all over the world, and there are men fighting everywhere without either victory or peace. Do you think the United States has got to take over in Indochina if the French pull out? You have.
Well, I don't think, Miss Craig, if the French should suddenly withdraw today, that there would be a possibility, even if the United States intervened in its most conceivably active fashion as the way it did in Korea, I don't think the prospects of success would be there, because the native population has shown no desire, because of many reasons, to take an active part in the struggle, as did the South Koreans. And without the support of the native population, there is no hope of success in any of the countries in Southeast Asia.
Well, Senator, I believe you have said that to lose Indochina was to lose all Asia.
That's correct.
But
unless the
do?
Prospects of victory are established, and I believe that they have not been established, obviously the reason why the population does not support the French effort is twofold. First, they're not convinced the French are going to win, and secondly, the French have been the colonial masters of that country for more than a century, and until the people are given real guarantees of independence, when the war is to be ended, naturally they're not supporting the fight against native troops. That's the difficulty. The French, Westerners, are fighting natives even though they're communists.
Well, Senator,
and the United States to intervene as Westerners against natives, particularly when the population has not supported the struggle in the past, I think would not guarantee the prospects of victory, and therefore it would be a mistake for us to go in.
Well, Senator, our new look in defense, which gives us air power and the weapons of air power, atomic and guided missiles, does that mean that we should strike directly at Red China or Red Russia or waste ourselves in satellite wars?
Well, I think one of the weaknesses of the policy that Mr. Dulles announced 3 weeks ago was that it only suited a major invasion. If the Russians, it gave clear notice that if the Russians should move into Western Europe, the Chinese into Southeast Asia, that the homeland of neither the Chinese or the Russians would be secure from attack. It does not, however, change these marginal or twilight wars like French Indochina, where the fighting is carried by natives, not by Chinese, but by natives indigenous in the country. And therefore, it's as the Chinese aid is true, it consists of about 1,000 tons, which is substantially less than the aid that we are giving the French. It would be difficult for us to suddenly announce that we're going to carry out an atomic attack on China and Russia, which would bring a major world war on.
Are you saying, then, that if France gives up Indochina, we should give up all Asia?
No, I'm not saying that at all. What I am saying, however, is that the French, and I don't believe they're going to give up French Indochina, if they should give up French Indochina, I don't think that there would be a prospect of holding French Indochina, and therefore we would have to move back a secondary line. What I hope, however, is that the French will make sufficient political concessions to win the support of the majority of the people, promise them certain independence and show real proof that they mean it, and therefore hope to win back not only manpower, but even more important, to be able to get the support of the educated group who will be the officers. As you know, Mrs. Craig, just recently some of the Vietnamese on the side of the French went over to the communists
and some of the territory which had been freed from Viet Minh troops went back to the communists.
Mr. Brooks.
Senator, getting back to this question raised by Mr. Childs, this advice given by President Eisenhower to his official family to practice moderation, that was raised by statements made by some Democrats that they were fearful that were that not done, the president's program might suffer the loss of support among Democrats. Now, do you really think that Democrats are going to withhold their support from very much of the president's program merely because of what Republicans... saying nasty things about him?
No, I don't think so, Mr. Brooks. I think, as the president, pointed out, the Democrats weren't voting for his program because of their regard for the Republicans. They were voting for those parts of his program with which they agreed. And therefore, I don't think that that will discourage the Democrats. The only thing is that I don't think political charges which are impinge on the loyalty of a great national party should be made. Well, by either side.
The Speaker of the House made that statement, I believe, that there might be some danger of loss of support. What do you suppose he had in mind?
Well, I think that he resented the implication that the Democratic Party was disloyal. But on the other hand, I believe that the support that the president will get comes from the soundness of his program and not because of party dispute.
Do you know of any move by Democrats to tone down some of their more vigorous orators?
Yes, I believe that you reach the point of diminishing returns in all of these extreme charges and countercharges. The American people really don't believe them. They don't help solve the problem. And I think it results in cynicism and distrust on the part of the people because they know that both sides are not devoting themselves to the more basic problem. Therefore, I suggest that that should be true of the Democrats.
Who should be in a position to do it? Who is the one person who is in a position to control?
Well, I think anyone in a position of responsibility has to be his own censor.
Mr. Spivak.
Senator, do you think that talk about a depression can start a depression, or that talk about the Democratic Party, any statement to the effect that they were traitors, will necessarily pin that label on the Democratic Party if it isn't true? Do you think the American people believe this political chit-chat?
Well, I don't think they believe that the Democratic Party is a party of treason. On the other hand, I do believe that if enough people in responsible positions talk about the dangers of recession, people become more conservative about their spending. They probably put more in the bank. Savings have risen in the last few months, and I think it does have a tightening up effect. If the basic underlying foundation is sound, however, of course, it can't. As after World War II, they thought there was going to be depression, and there wasn't. But if there are causes for legitimate concern, and then people talk about it, I think it does have a hardening effect, and I think it is unfortunate. On the other hand, you can't ignore it. What you want to do is not just talk about recession. You want to propose alternatives to meet the problem.
Well, the Republicans aren't talking about recession or depression. They're talking about prosperity. The only people, it seems to me, who are talking about depression are some of the labor people and a great number of the Democrats. Your advice, then, to your own party is that they better stop lest they starve of depression?
No, that isn't my advice. I think that there is room for genuine concern at the slowdown in economic activity. After all, our steel capacity is 75% when it was 108 or 9% some months ago, and there have been other indications of a slowdown in economic activity. Some economists predict it's going to be severe by the summer. Many of us hope that it will turn up again by spring. If it doesn't turn up again by spring, we'll have to take major steps.
Well, are you saying, then, that those Democrats who are warning against depression are talking not through their hats, but are talking facts, and that they're issuing warnings that ought to be listened to?
Providing in their warnings they propose alternative policies, then I believe they should be listened to. To talk merely about a depression, attempt to blame it on the Republicans without offering alternatives of your own is irresponsible and makes no contribution and does cause people concern, which does have an effect upon our economy.
Senator Jenner the other day said, and I quote this, the Democrats in 1952 had no national party to speak for them. Their party had been taken over in bits and pieces by the socialistic planners who were imitating the bankrupt governments of Europe. That's the end of the quotation. Now, as a member of the Democratic Party, were you conscious that the leadership was taken over by socialists?
No, I am not conscious of it because, of course, it is not a fact. Many may disagree with some of Governor Stevenson's recommendations, but certainly to suggest that he's a socialist is untrue. The leadership in the Democratic Party in the House, Sam Rayburn,
of Texas, Lyndon Johnson of Texas, supported by men like Dick Russell and Senator George and others. Paul Douglas in Illinois indicates to me that, of course, that's untrue.
Are you happy about the present leadership of the Democratic Party?
Yes, I am.
Mr. Childs.
Senator Kennedy, you've made a series of speeches in the House, and the Senate, rather, on how industry was attracted away from New England. And yet when you went down to Tennessee and made a speech about the Tennessee Valley Authority, you said you thought the TVA was a good thing for that region. Do you think the federal government should give a TVA or something like it to New England?
Well, I think that the federal government should, when there are natural resources that can benefit the people, I think the federal government should attempt to harness them, and that was certainly true of TVA. We don't have comparable resources, natural resources, in New England. There is now a survey going on, which is going to really give us the facts on our natural resources. But there, as I say, they're certainly not comparable to what is in the Northwest and in around TVA. I'm hoping, however, we will do something about Passamaquoddy and use whatever resources we do have. I think the federal government should assist us in doing that. As you know, out of the 156 hydroelectric projects in the country, New England doesn't have one. I think we've been on the short end, partly, and it's been partly due to our own fault.
You would disagree with President Eisenhower, then, that TVA is creeping socialist?
I don't think he'd probably agree today. They seem to be going back on it. Senator Noland and others have come out in support of it. Probably there's some difference about how far it should go in the next decade. But I agree with TVA because I think it's done wonderful things for the people of that area, and it's contributed indirectly to our prosperity. Whatever helps the people of an area that much, of course, helped us. What I was concerned about were practices which I did not think contributed to the South prosperity or New England, which has contributed to bringing industry from New England to the South. The payment of low wages and the payment unsatisfactory unemployment compensation stands, etc.
Well, now this Republican administration is trying to put contracts in the New England area. Is that going to help your industrial situation up there?
Well, I don't think that that program, Defense Manpower Policy Number 4, is terribly effective because it doesn't apply to the textile industry. That was one of the exceptions, and the textile area is the place where we've had the major problems. We only have four of the distressed areas in New England of the 22 or 3 that are in the country. So I wouldn't think that was a major assistance to us.
Mr. Craig.
Senator, President Eisenhower wants to give atomic information to our allies. Would you vote for that?
Well, I think if he recommends it and the Atomic Energy Committee approves it, as most of us who are not on the Atomic Energy Committee really have to take the advice of those in responsible positions, I would approve it.
Don't you think that perhaps since even within NATO we have weak sisters like France and Italy that might go neutral or fall into chaos, that it would be dangerous to do that?
Well, I doubt if the chiefs of staff and the president and the Atomic Energy Committees in the House and Senate would approve of the transferring information which would be of any benefit if known to the Soviet. What I think they want to do is to attempt to give them information about the use of weapons so that if a war should come, that they can fulfill their part in the assignment.
Do you think we're keeping sufficient defense here in the United States and Fortress America so that in case we got left alone in the world, we would have enough to defend ourselves?
Well, obviously, the first attack would come in the Far East and in Western Europe. Therefore, the attack would have to be met there. In addition, we hope that as you suggested, that retaliation would be our weapon. We have to rely on air bases in Europe and in Asia, and therefore, I think we are conducting a wise policy now.
Well, sir, how do you know that it will come there? Why not across the Atlantic direct
but
the
Arctic
on
the bases from which we must our retaliation would spring are in the main in Greenland, in Great Britain, on the continent of Europe, and in North Africa. And therefore, it's important to attempt to hold that position.
Mr. Spivak.
Senator, I don't like to come back again to Senator McCarthy, but one thing has troubled me some. How do you explain the fact that all of the Democrats have been criticizing Senator McCarthy's investigation? When it came to voting for his appropriation, only one lone Democrat in the Senate voted against it. Is that an indication to you that the Democrats believe that communism is going to be a very serious issue in this coming campaign?
Well, I think probably communism will be a serious issue in the campaign, but as far as the vote that the Government Operations Committee received, 85-1 for its appropriation, the reason, of course, was that the appropriation was the same as it was last year. The committee has important functions, checking the efficiency of the government, and the investigating subcommittee, of which McCarthy is the head, has the job of doing that. Many important investigations were conducted. Senator Potter into Korea, Senator Mundt into the whole story of turning over funds to the Soviet Union in after the war, etc. And therefore, just at that time, three Democrats had gone back on that subcommittee, and Senator McCarthy had made concessions to them, and therefore they all voted unanimously for it, and I think most of the Senate felt that the proper procedure was to give the committee the funds.
You don't think that it indicated a fear of crossing Senator McCarthy?
Well, many men who had crossed Senator McCarthy, like Senator Lehman and others, voted for it, so I think that they were voting for funds for the committee rather than attempting to make a judgment on the Senator McCarthy.
Senator, one more question on that subject before we leave it. They tell me that Senator McCarthy has some of his greatest strength in your state, and that his support could really elect a man and that his opposition might defeat him. Now, you know your state pretty well. What's your judgment on that?
I think Senator McCarthy probably could be of assistance to a Republican candidate in that state. Whether he could elect a man, I don't know. I'm very doubtful that anyone can elect anyone these days, but I think he could be of assistance. People pretty well make up their own mind, and they're interested in getting the right man for their own state, but I think he could be of assistance.
Mr. Brooks.
Senator, still on politics, you were mentioning a moment ago your satisfaction over the leadership of Mr. Stevenson.
I was talking in addition to the leadership in the Congress.
Yes. Would you be willing now to say that you favor his nomination for president at the next presidential
election? No, I think it would be premature. There are other men who have been talked about in the Congress, too, who would be strong candidates, and therefore I think they become announced candidates, and it would be premature.
You wouldn't take him out of the picture, though?
Not a bit. I think he's the leader of the party, and I think if he runs, and if he decides to run, he'd certainly be a strong candidate. I think that Senator Simonton, Kefauver...
How do you think you could overcome the fact with the rank-and-file Democrats who would be represented at a nominating convention that he was a man who carried only 9 states, I believe, and lost even part of the South? Could that be overcome, in your judgment?
Yes, it could be. There are going to be some direct primaries. He would have to enter those if he showed strength in the direct primaries. It would indicate that 1952 was not his fault. There were many other reasons for the success of the Republicans.
Well, he lost your state of Massachusetts by something like 200,000 while you were winning it. Does that indicate any... You won it by about 60,000. Does that indicate any great strength? I don't mean for you to be modest about this, about your own popularity up there, but would that indicate any great strength on his part?
Well, I think that it probably indicates that General Eisenhower was an extremely strong candidate. I would think, to be honest with you, that Governor Stevenson would have to enter primaries in various states in the country. If he showed his strength, if he beat the other people who were suggested, it seems to me that he would prove that he was the strongest man. But I think any candidate who's going to be the nominee next time will have to do that.
Mr. Childs.
Are you in favor of a raise in salary for yourself, Senator Kennedy?
Not to $27,500, but I believe that a raise in salary has been justified by the Siegel Committee.
How high would you go?
Well, I'm not terribly... I might go up to 20.
Are you feeling a pinch yourself?
I think that it's difficult to sustain the two homes. I think the proof has been brought out, and I think that, therefore, a raise is justified. You're going to have good men stay there. Particularly younger men who sooner or later have to go home and practice law again.
Mrs. Craig.
Senator, President...
It should go into effect, however, in January 1955.
Senator, President Truman took us into the Korean War without asking Congress. Do you think, as Senator Stennis says, that Eisenhower is inching us into a war in Indochina now?
No, but I do think that the technicians were probably unnecessary. The French have no conscription. Obviously, they could have provided the technician. We sent them, however, because we wanted to demonstrate that we were supporting the French. I don't think they were necessary as technicians, however, and therefore it is a step forward involvement in French Indochina. I don't think we should continue that involvement until the conditions are present, the political conditions are present to secure us victory if there is any deeper involvement.
Do you think Congress should be deprived of its right to declare war?
No, I don't.
Mr. Spivak?
Senator, Labor has grudgingly admitted that the Taft-Hartley Act hasn't destroyed it, but fears that in a depression it will do it great harm. Now, do you think that the Taft-Hartley Act is going to hurt Labor in case of a depression?
Well, I think its effects would be more severely felt, not so much among the strong unions, Mr. Spivak, but among the weaker unions, and particularly unions which are just beginning to get formed. And I think it would have a check on those areas of the country which are not organized, particularly the South, that a depression, of course, with the Taft-Hartley would be a much more accurate test of its provisions than has good times.
Well, aren't you satisfied that the amendments that your committee is proposing are going to take care of all that?
The amendments proposed by the President Eisenhower and Senator Smith? No, I don't. Because at least three or four of those provisions make the Taft-Hartley law more stringent than they are at present. Particularly the turning over to the states, the free speech section, and others, I think, are a step backward. I don't think that this... In fact, Mr. Spivak, I would say that, added up together, that the Taft-Hartley bill would be better off as it is now than to accept the plus and the minuses of the President's recommendation.
Our time is up. I'm sorry. Thank you ever so much for being with us, Senator Kennedy.
Thank you very much.
Here is our announcer.
Meet the Press, on Tuned to Yesterday, a radio and TV broadcast from the 14th of February, 1954, on NBC. And so ends this hour of underheard and unique programs from the past, and I hope you can be with us again for more collection curios on Tuned to Yesterday. I'm Mark Levonier. Thanks for listening.